accession number 21063, Rule 3.
Quadrinator Lee, Reel 3.
So we got on the train and set off up across Persia, past Qum, the sacred city with the sacred Muslim city with the golden domes of the mosques, and arrived in Tehran. We got out of the train in Tehran, and on the station platform, we met four or five pilots, RAF pilots, who were with their bags just going to get on the train to go back down to Kerem Shah, where we'd come from. So we said, "Oh, chaps, what are you doing here?" So we're just delivering some hurricanes to 123 Squadron. So what we could have done, we could have flown those hurricanes ourselves up there, but no, as the powers that be decided, we would go up by rail, and bus, and arrive at Tehran, and the aircraft would be flown by somebody else, and they would come back by railroad and bus. A complete waste. Anyway, so we arrived at this 123 Squadron, where we were stationed there. It was supposed to be the frontline defence of the Middle East against Hitler coming down the Caucasus. But by the time, that was Christmas 1943. So we were there. There was no kind of air activity, nothing, no raids. The Germans were hundreds of miles away still, but this was a precaution. Anyway, we were there for a couple of months, and then the CO of the 123 Squadron I joined fell ill and was posted, and I was given command of the squadron. So I brought the squadron, but reformed the entire squadron together, because we had one flight at Tehran and one flight at Abadan, where the oil refineries are in southern Persia. I reformed the squadron at Abadan, and then we flew back from there to the western desert, and where we were based at El Adam, which is now an international airport, I believe. That's on the North African Libyan coast. So there we started to do patrols and getting ready for when we were supposed to be getting re-equipped with Spit 9s to go back to England, and be part of the invasion force. But while we were there, when fighting these hurricanes and just doing literally no offensive action except intercepting, as we did, high-flying photographic aircraft, which were coming over, photographing the Delta, and we got a couple of 109 photo planes, shot them down. But then one day Max Aiken arrived and said, "All right, fellas, we've got a big plan. There are about 9 Hurricane squadrons left here in the desert, and we're all going to Crete. We're all going to give a raid at Crete one morning." So the plans were laid, and in July 1943, the Hurricane squadrons all flew in, and we had a big conference in a marquee which had been brought up specially for the occasion. And Max Aiken had the big board there, and he showed us diagrams of where the raids were. And then he said, "All right, very well, take off at 0700 hours in the morning." And I said, "All right, Max," who I'd known when we were together back in peacetime at Tangmere, and said, "But this is all very well, but who's leading this?" He said, "You are." So this is absolutely the first I heard of it. So we took off there and formated over at low level over El Adam, and the all 9 squadrons lined up behind, and we set off across the Mediterranean, led by a bow fighter, which was doing the navigation for us, to give us a landfall on this valley at the very south of Crete. And we arrived there, and as we crossed the coast, we all dropped our long-range tanks, which we had to have to get there and get back, and off up this valley. So where all these sketches it shown us of these ammunition dumps and these car parks we were going to raid, where there was nothing but trees, all olive trees, which were not, was we'd had no aerial photographs at all. It'd all been a sketch. So except for just firing your guns into the trees and hoping to hit something, there was absolutely nothing you could do. So we walked up all the way up this valley. We got to the end where you couldn't get over the mountains unless we were going to climb up and expose ourselves completely. So we turned back again, came back to the same valley, and as I came back out of the same valley, out to set over sea to fly back to North Africa, I glanced around the cockpit, as you do there, and just a cockpit check. First of all, I saw my oil pressure was right up off the clock, and my oil temperature was right up off the clock. My oil pressure was right off the bottom of the clock, and my feet were covered with oil, and which was spouting out from somewhere where I'd been hit from the ground. So I couldn't possibly set back over 100 miles of sea with no oil. So we had arranged for a landing area up in the mountains of Crete, where the guerrilla people would give us aid to try and get us out again. So I turned back inland, just on over the beach, and my engine cut out. So I had to force land in amongst the olive trees and the rocks on the beach there, and that was the end. So I came to a standstill, all very quiet for a moment. I got out and I took that little thermite bomb which we were given to put on the air. If you land an aircraft in one piece, you want to set fire to it. So I set for the little bomb and then set off running for the bushes. I ran for the bushes on the far side. And as I halfway across the space there, I was hit in the stomach, like as though I'd been hit by an express train, and knocked me out completely. So when I sat up this time, there was a German standing over me with a rifle pointing down at me. So he then points towards the pistol which I had, and so I take the pistol out and drop it to the ground as he stands there with his rifle. Then he sits up, and then off we go, hand ho, as I put my hands here over my head there, and off we go up the hill into this, and we wind up rather like a mountain village in Switzerland or Italy or somewhere like that. Exactly, just a little goat path up there. Eventually come over the crest of a hill, and there's a small village. And several German officers, all having their morning brandies, sitting at the tables in this little village. So they stand up there, and they all salute and bow and say, "Guten Morgen, Herr Major. Have you been wounded?" So I said, "Well, I've done the slightest idea." I said, "I've been hit in the guts, but I don't know what." So I was last able to put my hands down and have a little look. And what was... where my ammunition belt and my pistol belt had a bullet had gone straight through this, through the buckle and through the ammunition pouch on the other side, and scratched my tummy. But it had just gone straight on by, but given me this colossal bang in the guts. So anyway, there was nothing. I mean, didn't need any attention at all. So they said, "Have you had your breakfast?" So I said, "Well, no." So we sat down, had breakfast and brandies, and we had just sat there. So one of these men said, they spoke fairly good English. He said, "Herr Major, I wonder if you could do me a favour." He said, "Could you please tell, when you were interrogated, that when you were shot down, it was my machine guns on that hill that shot you down and not those buggers over there?" So... Then a staff car came along and took me along to Heraklion, where there was an air base. I was there overnight. We flew out the next morning in a Junkers 52.
So did you oblige that German?
Well, I was never interrogated there. I never had the chance. I wouldn't have thought of it anyway. But they were decent enough to go back to my aircraft, which had not burnt, but somebody had come and before the bomb had exploded, they got inside and they'd taken the bomb out and thrown it away. So the aircraft didn't burn. But fortunately, I knew this by this time because I could see nothing had happened. There had been a huge explosion. But I asked them, I said, well, could you... Because I always carried my uniform cap under my seat there. So my uniform cap's in that aircraft. Could you please get it for me? They went and got it for me. I was able to be presentable anyway to the Germans. And so we flew to Athens, then on to Vienna, and then on to Frankfurt on Main. So that I was captured on Friday morning. On Sunday afternoon, I was in the interrogation center in Frankfurt on Main, and I think they were keen because I was a fairly senior officer. It was about the time of the Sicily landings. They wanted to know whether they really intended to invade Crete or not. They were quite keen to interrogate, and although they were never really threatening or to me there, they did try every persuasion to get me to talk about what we were doing there and who we were. So they even still didn't know which squadron I was commanding, and which was a shame because I was actually wearing my May West water jacket, which one wears when flying over water. There, I was wearing that, and it had the squadron crest on it, but somebody had stolen it from me, so that they never could find out what squadron I was in.
What methods did they use to try to induce you to talk?
Well, they said, of course, if you don't tell your full information and everything of this issue, you will never be advised as to you're a prisoner. We shan't be able to pass on the information until we can really know who you are, who you say you are. Then they tried. They said, of course, if we could have a long chat about what you were doing in the desert and what you were going to do next, perhaps we could always go down to the pub in the woods there. You'd have a night, a couple of beers there, and there's some lovely girls there. And that was really all. I mean,
they didn't. What was your response to that?
Well, the response is just name, rank, and number. That's all you ever do. I mean, we're all taught that, aren't we? So that was it. There was in the bag. And that, so 20 months, and then we were out in the prison camp there in Staroluf 3, where the big escape was going, and that was an absolute traumatic experience when the escapers were shot, 50 of them were shot.
Were you involved in the Great Escape?
Only on the fringe, like everybody else in the camp. Everybody in the camp did something in the way of disposing of sand or standing on corners of the barrack blocks, keeping guard, again, whilst people did little tasks for the escape. Everyone in the camp was involved in some way in the escape. And then we, in December 1944, the Russians got very close to the German border, and they decided to move us. And one night we were suddenly rousted out of the barracks in the dark and driven out into the snow, and with what we could carry with us, and we were out in the snow in about 3 feet of snow for 3 days and nights.
Careful with the microphone.
Oh yes, sorry. But for about 3 days and nights. And then we were, eventually got on a train and went off back from the east of Germany, from the west of Germany, east of Germany, back to the west of Germany, where we were put in another camp there called in a Marlag near Hamburg. And then the Allied troops came the other direction and they moved us out of there, and we marched back in the opposite direction towards the Polish border. But before we got very long, we were overrun by British troops and released. That was the end of my war.
Can you describe your liberation by the British troops?
Yeah, with the liberation, we were all staying in a huge farm area of huge cattle barns and cattle yards, where we'd kept down in the hay, and all of a sudden a little scout car, a British scout car, came driving into the area, and the top opened and somebody said, "Who are you?" And we said, "Well, we're Stavanger 3. We've been moved from the far east of Germany." He said, "Oh, we've been looking for you all over Germany." So he called in his radio, and then that was it. And the German guards had by this, the German guards had already made a deal with us there. They said, "Now look, there's a bit of difficulty going on with all the troops and all the surrendering and what's going on there. What we'll do is we'll keep guard on you until your troops arrive. And when your troops arrive, we'll give you the guns and you guard us." So this is exactly what happened. But of course, what we did do was point out one or two of the guards who'd been very, 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 very strict or very ruthless. One or two people had been shot on this huge trek around Germany. And the troops that arrived took care of these people right away.
In what way?
Bumping them off.
Were you mistreated by any guards?
By no means, no. No, the Germans, as far as I was concerned, in this, were very correct. Their military discipline and their military honour wouldn't really prevent the Luftwaffe would not allow them to ill-treat prisoners.
How do you feel now about having served with Fighter Command in the Second World War?
Well, of course, there's been in these later years, there's been a terrible lot of, we seem to get more credit than we're really entitled to for what happened. We were there at the right time, but I mean, so was everybody else that was doing their bit. And I think we've had our reward to a great extent.
In terms of recognition, you mean?
In terms of recognition, if we're entitled, yes, we have. I think the Bomber Command. When I know what Bomber Command went through, I doubt that I would have had the moral fibre to have gone out night after night for 35 nights, 35 raids for one tour of duty. I did probably three tours of duty, but none of them were telling on my nerves to the same extent that you would be to go out at night, mind you, 8 hours or 9 hours at a time through terrible weather in many cases. And then the German air defence, night defences were superb.
When did you leave the RAF?
I was, when I got back, I was still a squadron leader, but the people who'd been my juniors, or I trained as a, were now already senior to me in many respects. And it was very difficult to get a job back with the squadron, even as a flight commander. So that I took advantage of early release, which you could have, and went immediately, and in December 1945, I went back to East Africa, where I'd enjoyed, when I had this flight across Africa, I'd enjoyed it so much, I thought I'd like to go and live there and work there. So I went out to Tanganyika and joined the United Africa Company, which was managing the groundnut scheme at the time.
Any memories of the groundnut scheme?
Well, only complete chaos and all the huge backlog of equipment on the docks, and the equipment was unsuitable for the job, in many cases for the job that it was intended, because the thing wasn't properly researched. It was, but my main job, of course, I was only shipping. We were only shipping agents for the groundnut scheme. It's not actually working on the groundnut scheme, but the main business we were in was the export of animal hides and skins, beeswax and ivory and similar. African trading.
You mentioned earlier two famous RAF officers with whom you served. Any more memories about Peter Townsend?
Well, Peter was my flight commander, and he was a regular officer, and I don't think he was... He was certainly wasn't what you could call one of the boys. His idea of pastime was to sit at home and read King's Regulations and Air Council instructions instead of going out to the pub with the lads. And
what prompted him to do that?
I've no idea. I mean, I think he had his career in mind.
And Harry Broadhurst?
Harry Broadhurst was my squadron commander when I joined 111 Squadron. And then I moved on, of course. I was just only a sergeant pilot then. So I didn't really get to associate with him in the mess. But then when I moved on to 43 Squadron, to Tangmere, Broadhurst had his early days of the war. He got his first few successes there and did quite well.